Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case set this afternoon, and I will ask Megan to call it.
May it please the court, Mr. William Harris arguing for relator, and Ms. Andrew Jacobs arguing for real
Mr. Harris?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court.
Counsel?
Scott Chamberlain pled guilty in 1997 to the offense of sexual assault. He was, as a part of a plea bargain, given a four-year deferred adjudication probation. He entered that plea October 10th, if memory serves, 1997, and on September 1st, 1997, the legislature's amendment of the Sex Offender Registration Act went into effect. The crime itself was committed in 96, and at that time the registration requirement for most of the time the case was pending that Mr. Chamberlain would have been subject to was for 10 years after the time he was released from whatever punishment he had been assessed for the offense, which in this case would have been the deferred adjudication. Mr. Chamberlain asserts in his affidavit that he was never informed that on the 1st of September 1997 the requirement for his offense had changed from one of 10 years after release to one of a lifetime commitment. The state is correct in its answer that at the time there was still a process by which he could have sought to have that waived, but since he didn't know that the change had been made, he had no reason to petition for an exemption from the 99-year change. He has said in his affidavit that had he known that, he would not have entered a plea that he entered not because he felt he was guilty, but because he wanted to escape the risk of going to the penitentiary. Now, his attorney, the Honorable Bill Lane, has said that he does not remember the case specifically, that his file on the case has been destroyed, and that because this was a hot issue at the time, however, he believes that he would have informed Mr. Chamberlain of the fact that it was a lifetime obligation. The problem with this is that in this instance, and the first point that I've raised on appeal is that the court should have granted a live hearing on this issue and on the issue of the voluntariness of the plea. Should have done so because cross-examination and the demeanor of Mr. Lane and Mr. Chamberlain would have been helpful to the court in making a decision about whether it believed Mr. Chamberlain or Mr. Lane.
Doesn't the trial court have absolute discretion on that issue, though?
It would seem that it does, and certainly the statute, I admit, says that the court may conduct the hearing by affidavit, in other words, a paper hearing. And there's a similar but not equivalent right to do that in 11071 cases. There's not an instance that I could find where the Court of Criminal Appeals has criticized a court for doing that in Texas, although the Fifth Circuit criticized indirectly this same court, indirectly the Federal District Court for the Northern District here in Fort Worth, for failing to conduct an evidentiary hearing in Hall versus Quarterman. In that instance, the problem was that Mr. Hall had maintained for some time that he was, that he was mentally retarded. And at the time of his trial, that was not an exception to the imposition of the death sentence. So the same issues weren't before the court. Later, after the Adkins decision, that changed. And from that point forward, that became a relevant issue, but there was never a hearing on it. And there was a great deal of controversy in that case. There were, I believe, ultimately something like six different people that looked at his mental abilities. I was the trial counsel on the original trial, so I can speak to at least the first one. And the Fifth Circuit said that because this was such a contested issue, and because at the time that the Texas trial court, Criminal District Court Number 1 of Tarrant County, decided the issue, Briceño had not been decided by the Court of Criminal Appeals, so there was no guidance there. It's not directly on point, I admit that. But the thing that I think is important in that is their recognition that a live hearing can afford the court with information through the testing vehicle of cross-examination as well as the demeanor of the witnesses to make a better and finer judgment on who's telling the truth. In this instance, Mr. Lane does not say that he did warn Mr. Chamberlain. He says he doesn't have a specific memory. He feels sure from his custom that he would have. Without gainsaying that, Mr. Chamberlain, for whom, unlike the attorney, this is a singular event, has a specific memory of this happening. And let me point out as a corollary that in this particular case, he has submitted an affidavit, which is the same as testimony. There are two or three places where the state has alleged that there's no evidence of some of the allegations he made in his affidavit. I submit that the affidavit is the evidence. It's his testimony because we didn't have a live hearing. And while it may not be persuasive, it doesn't render it not evidence. However, if I may, I'm going to jump to what I think is really the main issue in the brief, and that is the question of whether or not the Texas Sex Offender Registration Program violates substantive due process. As the court knows, the 14th Amendment prohibits any state from infringing upon fundamental liberties. And there are a number of different liberties that have been identified in the Supreme Court's opinions on this matter. Their jurisprudence was the word I was looking for. And most recently, Lawrence versus Texas. They have held that there are certain things that the government simply can't tread upon, that they are basic liberties. In this instance, I have suggested that this statute and this Registration Act, because of its broad sweep and its lack of discrimination on the different facts of the cases, the history of the individuals who are required to report, all of these things makes it an overreaching and arbitrary statute that deprives these individuals not just of their reputation, but also of their human dignity. Now, I concede reputation while enjoying a period of being recognized as a fundamental liberty under Wisconsin versus Constantineau. Subsequently, that decision was reversed under Paul v. Davis, and the court has held you have to show something more. I submit, though, that human dignity is something more than merely reputation. Human dignity relates to how we are all treated, how we perceive ourselves, how we conduct ourselves in our communities, with our associates, how we go about our day, how we conduct our business. It should be one of the purposes of the criminal justice system when people commit a crime and pay the price for it, that at some point, if they reform their behavior, they get to go forward with their lives and maintain their dignity. Now, the state points out that our state says that human dignity is necessarily attached with or related to intrusion of the body. And certainly some of the cases do relate to whether or not the state may compel feeding, compel the taking of a blood sample without violating, in other words, without a warrant, without violating the dignity of the human being. I don't gainsay that those are areas where dignity applies, but the Supreme Court clearly extends this concept beyond that. In Lawrence versus Texas, one of the things the Supreme Court says that people who are homosexual and who are engaging in consensual homosexual conduct as adults in private should have is the right to retain their dignity as free persons. In Roper versus Simmons, the case that decided that we would not apply the death penalty to persons who committed their crime before attaining the age of 18, the court recognized that one of the great strengths of our Constitution was its respect by the American people, and that, quote, the doctrines and its broad provisions to secure individual freedom and preserve human dignity. Roper versus Simmons was certainly not about the invasion of the body with a needle or a feeding tube or something like that. There have been some rulings against substantive due process. As the court knows, in Connecticut versus Doe, the Supreme Court reserved finding on that issue. They had invited the parties to address it. They had specifically elected not to. So Connecticut versus Doe was a decision primarily, and to the extent it was about due process, it was about procedural due process. Procedural due process is also something that the Court of Criminal Appeals has found is met by our procedure with respect to the sex offender registration program.
Do you consider your constitutional challenge to be facial or as applied?
I suppose the answer is both. Facial to the extent that I think this statute is overreaching because it doesn't allow for judicial discretion in exercising either the requirement of registration or the length of registration. Individually applied, I think there are factors that suggest that this is clearly an excellent example of a young man who reformed, who had no prior criminal history. The assault, the factual basis of the assault, was an adult upon adult situation. He met this young woman at a nightclub in Arlington. She came back to a friend's apartment with him where they drank and danced. His two friends that were there witnessed her dancing with him very affectionately, ultimately taking off her blouse and dancing with him in front of them before he and she retired to the bedroom. After they had done so, the next day, her conduct toward Mr. Chamberlain was one of affection. It certainly was not anything that suggested that she felt that she had been sexually assaulted the preceding evening. So, to begin with, you have a very close fact situation on the issue of whether consent was granted, withheld, or whether she was incapable of giving consent because of the amount she had had to drink. There could easily have been a situation where, frankly, the lack of consent was not conveyed, and Mr. Chamberlain, who was also drinking, didn't fully apprehend the situation either. So there are a lot of things there in the facts of the incident itself that suggest that he is not a dangerous sexual predator. Secondly, you've got a man who, in addition to never having had trouble with the criminal law prior to this, though he did have an episode where there was a petition to revoke, proceed to adjudication filed. It was subsequently dismissed after he spent some time in jail. He ultimately completed the probation. And since he completed the probation, and it was dismissed in 2001, he has had no further problems with the criminal justice system. He has married. He has raised a family or is raising a family. He has a business. And he has been a good citizen. So once again, as applied in this case, he is certainly not a sexual predator. He was evaluated by Lauren Dean, one of the sex offender counselors here in Fort Worth, and her affidavit is attached as part of the realtor's response to the state's answer early on in the original litigation. I would submit that here, if we back up to these cases that have looked at substantive due process and held that similar or relatively similar reporting statutes, or registration statutes, I should say, don't violate substantive due process. They have done so largely, and these are the cases cited in the state's brief, they have largely done so by defining the liberty interest very, very narrowly. What they're saying about the liberty interest is these people are saying they have a liberty interest in not being required to register. I submit that there's more involved than that. Registration of a sex offender is not merely the publication and exposure of the historical fact that this person either pled guilty to or was convicted of a sex offense. It is more than that. It is the branding of these people as dangerous sexual predators. And it follows that there's an assumption at operation here, and there are some studies now that call that assumption into question, that sexual predators are all dangerous, that all sex offenders are going to be recidivists. In fact, the highest recidivism rate seems to be young men who commit armed robbery. They're not required to register. The state could have drawn a statute that was more narrow and allowed for judicial discretion to examine the history of the individual, to examine the facts of the case, and perhaps even down the road to examine whether or not the person has proven over many years that they have reformed. And in doing so, they would have better facilitated weeding out the true sexual predators, which admittedly are out there, from people who simply committed a sex crime at some point in their life and pose no threat to society any more so than any person that has never committed a crime. That's the problem with the statute. It treads on that human dignity. It says that people can never recover that because we're going to brand them as something dangerous without any study other than that assumption, and they're going to lose that part of their liberty. That's the essential liberty, and I think that's what the statute does that violates substantive due process. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Jacobs?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Jacobs. I'm here on behalf of the state of Texas, the appellee in this matter. The two issues that he was denied, that he should have had a hearing before the trial court denied it, and also that the sex offender registration violates substantive due process. I believe the briefing is very clear, and we briefed this thoroughly in our brief, but I wanted to note a couple issues here. Regarding the denial of a hearing, 6B of 11072 does allow for the trial court to decide what it needs when decide for what evidence it'll have. It can hold a hearing, it can have depositions, interrogatories, do it based on affidavits. It's very discretionary. In this case, we didn't just have two affidavits. We didn't have the affidavit of the defendant and the affidavit of the counsel. We also had the facts in the record itself. The trial court made a personal recollection that she was aware of the change in the law. That is also, you know, that the fact that counsel said this was a hot-button issue, and no, I don't remember this particular case, but I do remember this was a big issue. And trial court's personal recollection is also that she also knew of the change in the law. 2 years after his plea, he still had employed Mr. Lane as his attorney. Now, if he felt that his attorney caused his plea to be involuntary and gave him erroneous advice, then the question is, why did he still employ Mr. Lane as his attorney?
Doesn't that actually cut in his favor? I mean, if he thought that he only had to register for 10 years, why would he be upset in 2 years?
He does not allege that he, when he learned that he'd have to do a lifetime registration, he doesn't allege when he learned that whole thing, but the reality is when you go and you start registering, they're going to tell you how long you've registered. No, I don't have evidence of when he was told, but he doesn't allege when he was told either. But within 2 years, he should have learned by registering timely and talking with his community supervision officers that he would have to have a lifetime registration. So to say that he didn't know it when he pled, but then after 2 years, he still didn't know, I think
there's nothing in the record that they told him that either.
Well, no, there's nothing in the record, but he never alleges when he did find out.
Now, does Mr. Lane's affidavit mention anything about telling him that there was a way to get around this?
He doesn't explain. He just says, you know, I knew that it was a lifetime registration, and no, he doesn't explain that he did advise him because he doesn't remember this client. But he was very aware of the law.
His affidavit says that he was sure that he would have told him that the 10 years had changed to lifetime.
Yes.
Does his affidavit say anything about, but even if it is, I remember telling him that even if it was lifetime, there was a way to get around that if the trial court holds a hearing and finds that you aren't a danger anymore?
No.
Say anything about that?
No, because he doesn't remember this one client.
Well, then doesn't that kind of tell us that he probably didn't tell the fellow about that, or about the 10 years? Because obviously if he told him about, by the way, there's a way to get around this, obviously the guy would have tried to exercise that election.
Well, I don't know. I just know
well,
that
I'm saying that cuts
he's saying
Mr. Harris's client's favor that he didn't do anything about it, that he didn't know anything about it, because it's such an obvious thing to do if he'd have been made aware of it.
But to say that he didn't know it would be a lifetime registration after 2 years, he still didn't know, I mean, that seems to cut the other way, because the issue here is, you know, he goes and he talks to the community supervision officer and they've got the paperwork in the file that says, yeah, I agree to all this, and then he goes and he starts registering. I think I'm pretty confident that the paperwork would say, okay, you have a lifetime registration. And at that time, if he didn't know beforehand, then he'd go, I have a lifetime registration.
But he still had an opportunity to obtain an exemption for 2 years.
Right, and he's never not alleging he didn't. He's saying he didn't know at all. He thought it was 10 years. You know that it was 10 years.
Sounds like all the more reason to have a hearing to find out. Did your parole officer tell you any of this? I mean,
well, counsel's affidavit never said. You know, he doesn't remember, and so we don't actually have the two. It's not just two affidavits. It's all this other stuff. And so I don't know.
That it raising questions, it sounds like to me. All this other stuff is raising questions about what did he know, what he didn't know, what did the parole officer tell him, what did he not tell him, when did he first learn? I mean, there's so many holes in this cheese, somebody needs to fill them in, kind of sounds like to me.
Well, it could have led to the credibility of his affidavit as well, because in his affidavit he says, you know, with no possibility that I had, you know, if I had known that I couldn't, you know, have to register for life with no possibility, that wasn't the law at the time either. He did have this exemption in place, and so to say that he had no possibility, that's not even a correct termination of our definition of what the law was at the time. That changed 2 years later. So, I mean, even his affidavit doesn't say, you know, I wasn't told If I had known that it was lifetime but I could get off, he doesn't even allege that. What he alleges is a law that happened 2 years later. So the fact that he waited 10 years to complain, and there is, you know, if he had alleged that he found out at 10 years that, yeah, I know it's a lifetime registration, that'd be one thing. But he doesn't allege that at all. He never alleges when he found out. So he's waited 10 years to complain. So I think with the court, you know, when she looked at everything that was available in the record, she made the determination that no hearing was needed. And so under 6B, she could do that. And I think that, you know, within her discretion, she was allowed this. And she did it by the guidelines of 6B. So
isn't it true that at the time he pleaded guilty that an admonishment on the sex offender registration wasn't even required?
It wasn't, no.
So how does that... I'm not seeing what you're pointing to as other evidence that he would have known.
Well, the
lifetime registration.
The admonishments that he did sign did include the sex offender registration information. It didn't say specifically what the timeline was, but it said, you know, you acknowledge that you have to follow the sex offender registrations of the state of Texas or what other state you reside in.
How's that helpful to him?
Well, it was circled, and there's some indication that they went over that.
But if it doesn't tell him that it's 10 years or life, how does that help him? How does that help him know what it is if it doesn't say,
well,
and you're going to have to register for life?
This was a hot topic at the time, and counsel is confident that he told him the correct law.
Go back to that again. Okay.
Well, and then the trial court also knew the change in the law as well.
I was kind of wondering, what import does that have? If the trial judge knows it, okay.
I believe the concern is, it sounds like that they're trying to portray the counsel as not knowing the change in the law, that this was something that just changed quietly and nobody knew that it went from 10 years to lifetime. And that's not what happened here. It was a hot issue. Everybody in the legal community knew about it. It wasn't like it just happened. So that Mr. Lane says, well, yes, you know, I don't remember this particular client. I've had a lot of clients. But I know that this was a big issue and this was controversial, and I would have told him. Because it was such a big issue, I was aware of that change in the law. So that goes to the fact that he was aware. It wasn't like he didn't know the law.
But I think the point is, it doesn't really matter who was aware or wasn't aware. It only matters what he was told, what Mr. Chamberlain was told, right?
Right. And 11 years later, I mean, all we have is his affidavit saying what he was told. And what he says he was told isn't even what the law was when he was told it. I mean, he says, without a possibility, but there was a possibility. So him saying, if I had known that I had no possibility, that wasn't the law at the time. The law at the time was he had a possibility to be exempt off that. So his affidavit itself doesn't allege that the law at the time. It alleges the law 2 years later, and there's no way counsel could have known that the law would have changed 2 years later.
I'm not following the 2 years later.
In his affidavit, In his affidavit, he says, if I had known that I would have to, you know, register for life with no possibility of getting off of it, I would not have pled guilty. In 97, the law was, it's lifetime. It changed September 1, 97. It's lifetime, but the trial court can exempt you out if you show some evidence with some doctors, and, you know, they have a very clear thing to do to bring to the court. It would be within the court's discretion to say you don't need to be on sex offender registration anymore.
But now he has no possibility of getting out.
Right, because that happened in 99, September 1, 99, 2 years after he pled guilty, the law changed and removed that discretionary section.
But what I'm not following is, how does the fact that he was unaware that he could get an exemption show that he knew that he had lifetime registration? His position seems to be consistent. He was never told anything about this lifetime registration or exemption or anything.
Well, that is consistent with what he says, but when you look at the other, you know, the fact that it was a hot topic, the trial court, and the fact that he still employed Mr. Lane 2 years later, that he should have, you know, he would have learned about it 2 years later. You look at all that other evidence, and then it becomes less consistent.
But was his employment of Mr. Lane on this particular case?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's a letter that Mr. Lane wrote to the court.
Okay.
On the second issue with the sex offender registration, we have the substantive due process. There are, you know, a case in the Ninth Circuit where the court actually says, We do not believe that Glucksberg and Smith permit us to reach any other result in this case. We conclude that the Alaska law does not violate Doe's right to substantive due process. They're basing it on a Supreme Court decision, trying to find whether or not the Alaskan sex offender violates due process. There's many cases that discussed in my brief about the different jurisdictions that have decided that the similar sex offender registration statutes do not violate substantive due process. There is an excellent case that I did not cite in my brief that is a Supreme Court case based on an Alaska statute where they're discussing ex post facto, but they actually say they're discussing how it's a good discussion about how sex offender registration and comparing it to branding, things like, you know, with a T or an M for murder, T for thief, all these public humiliation things in the stocks. And the Supreme Court of the United States says, by contrast, the stigma of Alaska's Megan's Law results not from the public display for ridicule and shaming, but from the dissemination of accurate information about a criminal record, most of which is already public. The purpose and the principal effect of notification are to inform the public for its own safety, not to humiliate the offender. So when we're looking at the substantive due process and whether it's a liberty interest, the Supreme Court does a great job of explaining how this isn't like other actions where it's, you know, for humiliation. This is actually for, you know, notification, and it's not to humiliate. When deciding whether or not substantive due process, you've got the two prongs. The first prong is whether or not it's a fundamental or liberty interest. This court in In re MAH discusses reputation. Now, counsel does discuss how this rises to the level of human dignity. It's a much broader term, but even his own terms about the ability to conduct business, to go about your day, things about dignity in his brief, hold his head high, reputation, rebuild his dignity, and lifetime of wall of shame, these are still reputation issues. These are still about, you know, him, the defendant, and in his, you know, how the society sees him, and that's still a reputation issue. And the court again and again has held that reputation is not a fundamental liberty interest. Even though in In re MAH they didn't discuss, they didn't, you know, y'all didn't say substantive due process, you did say the magic words with the rational basis. Dissemination of registration information is a rational means towards a legitimate state interest. The registration and notification statutes bear a rational relationship to the state's interests sought to protect and advised by the legislation. And so this all shows this court's already decided that second prong about whether or not there's a rational basis. If once you find that it's not a fundamental liberty interest, the second issue is this a rational basis standard. And this court's already found that it passes the rational basis standard. Also, regarding the fact that the defendant and the specific facts of his case versus a facial argument with the specific facts, this court held in In re MAH that, however, whether application of the program should be contingent upon the juvenile's age or seriousness of the offense is a question left to the legislature. And just like that, this is another issue that should be with the legislature, the fact that bases the facts of the case and let the legislature decide whether or not there should be some sort of guiding path or different grades of offense. Specifically, appellant argues that the statute should be in place to look at that and to have a hearing and to discuss, you know, the specific facts of each case. That was done in 97. The trial court had discretion to decide whether or not, you know, if they've met this, then they could be removed. But they changed the law in 99. This legislature did change it to remove that discretion. So it's clear from the legislative intent that they do not want this. So,
do you think that the legislative intent in the facts of this case that this person should have to register for life?
I believe that the facts of the case that the woman was assaulted, and that's what he pled to, yes. Are there any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. Mr. Harris, do you have any rebuttal?
Very little, Your Honor. I'll be probably uncharacteristically brief. On the first issue, the question of whether he knew it was a lifetime obligation, I would simply submit to the court that there are two or three things the state has alleged that I would take issue with. First off, with respect to his community supervision officers, under the statute that existed prior to the plea, prior to September 1st, 1997, he would have had an obligation to register for 14 years, 4 years of his deferred adjudication plus 10 years after that. The term of how long he would have to register would never necessarily have become an issue for the community supervision officer, because during the entire time he's on community supervision, he would have that requirement, both as a condition of his community supervision as well as under the statute. Second, his employment of Mr. Lane, I agree with the courts, tends to suggest that he still didn't know that anything had changed with respect to the law. His learning that there was a lifetime obligation could well have come well after the 1999 change in the law, which made it irrefutable. In fact, had he been informed that there was this lifetime obligation and this opportunity to petition for an exemption from it, one would expect that something would have been done. It would appear either in the negotiation of the plea papers, something written in there. It might have, there might have been a hearing, a motion to have the court consider waiving that as a part of the plea. But none of these things appear in the record. So there's nothing in the record to suggest that, despite the fact the judge had knowledge of it, she's not required to make an admonition as to the term of the sex offender registration. The fact that it appears on the amended conditions, the way things generally work, those conditions are not usually shown to the person placed on community supervision until after the plea process is completed. And in any event, as Justice McCoy pointed out, those conditions simply tell him what he already knew, presumably, and that is that he was going to have some duty to register as a sex offender in the future. Finally, it is not my purpose or my suggestion that Mr. Lane was ignorant of the law. But being aware of the law and always advising your client of it is not necessarily the same thing. I can only say I have seen good lawyers advising clients in the hallway outside of our courts in this building, and they have said things that omitted things that I would have said. Not that it's my business to jump in and help. I don't think that would be appreciated, and I don't know what conversations they may have had with their client previously. So you cannot consider, you cannot take from the silence that he had knowledge. I just don't think you can impute that from the silence.
I can't feature any scenario under these facts where Mr. Lane, not being the good lawyer that he is, would not have seen to it that this motion to escape the effect of the 10-year statute wasn't employed.
Judge, I can't disagree with that. Bill is a fine lawyer. I've known him most of my professional life, but all lawyers are human and can make mistakes, omissions, forget something. Frequently when new statutes are enacted, I confess I don't always go read all of them before September 1st. I sometimes wind up playing catch-up in October, November, and December, and it could well be that the hot issue was the lifetime registration, and the fact that there was an exemption process may not have been the thing that was the focus of the discussion of the statute when it changed. I personally can't remember. I was certainly practicing back then, and I would agree it was an issue, but I don't recall that part of it now either. So I suppose I might be in the same boat that Mr. Lane is in here. If there are no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris. Thank you both for your good arguments. Your case is submitted, and you will hear from us shortly. Thank you both this afternoon. The court is adjourned.